a Victorian True Crime podcast. My name is Kim, and tonight's story is a love triangle that ends in murder. This is the story of Mary Percy. But first, a Victorian society tip. Since plenty of us are preparing to go back to school this month, I wanted to share a list of rules for teachers from 1886 that recently made me laugh out loud. The first section is titled Duties. 1. Wash windows and clean classroom with soap and water once a week. Not so bad so far, I guess. It's your classroom, you should keep it tidy. 2. Check outhouses daily. Plenty of old catalogs are available at the school board office. So, keep the toilet paper stocked is your second official duty as a teacher, I suppose. The second section is apparel, forbidden to wear at any time. Ladies, if you want to be a teacher, don't ever be caught wearing 1. A bathing costume, 2. Bloomers for cycling, 3. No skirts slit to expose ankle, and 4. No bustle extension over 10 inches. I agree with that one. That's just excessive bustle. Next are the apparel rules for men. Men are forbidden to wear 1. Detachable collar and necktie removed from shirt, 2. Shirt sleeves unlinked and rolled. Men's forearms are akin to women's ankles in classrooms, apparently. And 3. Men cannot have their hair closely cropped. And handwritten in next to this rule, it says, unless bald or have disease of the scalp. In other words, if you're bald, you do not have to grow hair for this job. Thoughtful of them to add that. The last section is conduct, and there are 3 rules here that if you break is cause for immediate dismissal. 1. Smoking of cigarettes, use of spirits, and frequenting of pool or public dance halls. Well, that's already 4 rules, actually, so that's not very fair, but on to rule number 2. Marriage, or other unseemly behavior by women teachers. I'm sorry, women could not get married to be a teacher, but a man could? Which brings us to rule number 3, joining of any feminist movement such as the suffragettes. Damn women and their rights. That is the end of the flyer, signed off on by the superintendent. And my question is, who are you, Mr. Superintendent, creeping around the pool and dance halls, keeping tabs on all these teachers, watching to make sure I don't wear my bloomers or on my bike ride? Worry about yourself. Everyone have a happy and safe back to school season. Before we get into the story, I have my first couple of Patreon supporters to thank. They are Haley and Katie. Thank you, Haley and Katie. So, a Goodnight for a Murder Patreon includes 3 tiers. The first is the Chambermaid and Footman tier. That includes my eternal thanks. The middle tier is the Ladies Maid and Valet tier, where you get a shout out and a sticker. And the third tier is the Housekeeper and Butler tier, which includes a shout out, a sticker, a Victorian-inspired handwritten thank you postcard from me, and bonus content with every episode. At the end of each episode, I tell you exactly what the bonus content is, and you can even find little previews of bonus content on social media, but for the full stories, you have to join. So, I'm just starting out. I am a team of exactly 1, so every little bit helps, and if you'd like to consider joining on Patreon as well, you can learn more at agoodnightforamurder.com. But please remember, you can always rate or review on Apple and Spotify to help out for free. On another note, we've made it 10 episodes in, and I have decided I've got to start including content warnings at the top of each episode, starting with this one right here. I haven't included them so far because disturbing content just comes with the territory of being a true crime podcast, but for legal reasons, it probably is wise to do. Plus, this episode in particular deals with the death of a child. So from here on out, you'll hear a generic content warning at the top of each show, plus if there are any specific warnings for that episode, okay? So now on to the story. Mary Percy was born Mary Eleanor Wheeler in England, 1866. Not much is known about her early life, but it can be assumed that she led a fairly standard middle-class life. As she grew older, she did try to move in circles that would let her attach herself to wealthier men. And by the time she's about probably 17 or 19 years old, She's attached herself to a man named Charles Percy, who earned a decent income as a carpenter. Now, they never married, but they did live together, so this is how Mary took on the last name Percy. Now, it sounds like Mary was living with Mr. Percy for some time, but also had an apartment that was being paid for her on Priory Street, Kentish Town, North London, by another man named Charles Creighton. So, Mary is not faithful to Mr. Percy, and eventually they split up. Those who knew her around this time said she was prone to bouts of depression and drinking heavily. The next interest of Mary's we need to talk about is Frank Hogg. It sounds like she first met Frank when she was living with Charles Percy, but then it's revealed that they are not actually married, and when she moves into the Priory Street apartment, Mary gives Frank a key, and they start having a relationship. Frank, though, is also seeing someone else named Phoebe Stiles. Now, it doesn't seem like there's too much drama here until Phoebe gets pregnant. And Frank tries to break things off with Mary because he's going to have to marry Phoebe now. So maybe at first Mary was okay with the arrangement, you know, like they were both seeing other people. But now Frank is choosing someone else over her, she feels differently. Either way, Frank does marry Phoebe and they have a daughter together whom they name after her mother, Phoebe. But he also keeps up the affair with Mary the entire time. Eventually, Mary asks Frank to introduce her to his wife so that maybe they can be friends. And he does, though it doesn't sound like Phoebe ever knew the true relationship between her husband and Mary. But Mary does kind of insert herself into their lives. At one point when Phoebe was sick, Mary would come over to their house, take care of the housework, take care of the baby, even care for Phoebe until she's recovered herself. All the while continuing to carry on their affair for all in all about a year and a half after the baby is born. There's nothing on record to indicate Phoebe is suspicious at this time, but if we all think for a minute and try to put ourselves in Phoebe's shoes, I would be watching that woman like a hawk. It does come to pass eventually that Phoebe shares some of her misgivings about Mary with her sister. In September of 1890, Phoebe receives a note to meet Mary at a nearby public house. A little unexpected, since it's been about 7 or 8 months since she last saw Mary. But Phoebe goes, and when she meets her there, she tells her she wants to invite Phoebe to go to the seaside with her. She said, "Don't worry about the baby, you can leave her with a nurse I know, and I want to go look at this empty house down there in South End, and it'll be a fun little girls' trip." So Phoebe gets a vibe and is like, "Huh, I'll get back to you." And she goes on her way. But in her mind, she's thinking, hell no, I'm not going with you to some empty random house by the sea. No one would even think to look for me there if anything happens. Absolutely not. So Phoebe goes back and tells her sister of this bizarre encounter with Mary, which confirms for us that yes, Phoebe did not trust Mary Percy. The next month, on October 24, 1890, to be precise, Mary stops a neighborhood boy and pays him a penny to deliver a note to Phoebe Hogg for her. The note reads, "Dearest, come round this afternoon and bring your or our little darling. Do not fail." Phoebe, most certainly against her better judgment, goes. Around 4 p.m., neighbors hear screaming and sounds of a fight and glass breaking coming from Mary's home. Now, no one reported this at the time. It just came out later that at least one neighbor heard a commotion coming from the house. Also not reported at the time was that multiple neighbors and pedestrians saw Mary Percy pushing a baby carriage that didn't have a baby in it, but was piled high with something that was covered by a large dark blanket. At about 7 p.m. that evening, the body of a woman was discovered in a rubbish pile in Hampstead. Google Maps tells me that's about a 3-hour walk from Mary's home. The woman's skull had been crushed and she was nearly decapitated. About a mile away from where the woman's body was found, they found an empty, blood-soaked baby carriage. A perambulator is the word they actually used then, if that helps paint a picture for you. The next morning, about an hour's walk from where they found the empty carriage, they found a 12-month-old girl that had been smothered. The press reported about the discovery of the body, and upon hearing about it, Frank and Phoebe's sister Clara go to the police station to report Phoebe missing. Frank also asks Clara if she'll go to Mary's to see if she's seen Phoebe. I don't know why Frank doesn't go to see Mary himself. I'm going to assume he was being held back by the police station for questioning or something. Anyway, Clara arrives at Mary's and she says, "No, I haven't seen Phoebe, but I'll go with you to the morgue to view this unidentified body they found." Wow, what a friend, right? So the two women go to the morgue, and Mary starts acting strangely. First, she tries everything she can think of to try to prevent Clara from going in to ID the body, which does not work. Clara is like, I'm going in, and she positively identifies the body of her sister, Phoebe Hogg. Plus, she confirms the empty baby carriage did indeed belong to Phoebe and her baby. After viewing the body of Clara, Mary reportedly flies into hysterics. She's screaming, crying, way over the top. Meanwhile, Frank is informed that Clara confirmed the body is his missing wife, and Frank comes clean to the police about the affair he's been carrying on with Mary. So police head to Mary's house to question her. When they get there, Mary is home and lets them right in. They take one look around and they see a kitchen covered in blood spatter, clear signs of a struggle, including two broken window panes, along with a blood-stained fire poker and carving knife, apparently not at all concealed. The entire time they're having this look around, which is just them standing there eyeballing her kitchen, not even searching for anything, Mary sat at the piano in the other room, playing, singing, and whistling loudly, very nonchalantly, as if she didn't have a care in the world. When the police ask her, "Hey Mary, where did all this blood come from?" she responds, "Oh, I have nosebleeds." And when they say, "Hey Mary, what's with the bloody fire poker and knife?" she answers, "Oh, I've been killing mice." And when they press her on that, she apparently got really weird and started chanting, like, "Killing mice, killing mice, killing mice." Like, I'm imagining when a child pretends they can't hear you and they cover their ears and are like, "La la la, can't hear you." Like, they're trying to question her and she refuses to even acknowledge them speaking to her. Like, "Nope, killing mice, la la la." So when they investigated further, they found bloodstained clothes of Mary's and they found that Mary was wearing Phoebe's wedding ring. Investigators concluded that Mary lured Phoebe and her daughter to her home, where she murdered Phoebe in the kitchen, first by hitting her on the head with the fire poker, then cutting her throat with the carving knife. She then loaded her body into the baby carriage on top of baby Phoebe, who then died of suffocation. She tucked a blanket over the bodies and wheeled the carriage out of her home and about 8 miles to Hampstead. As mentioned, this would be nearly a 3-hour walk before the carriage broke down and she left Phoebe where it collapsed. She then must have wheeled the busted carriage about another 2 miles to Hamilton Terrace, about a 40-minute walk this time, before giving up on it and carrying baby Phoebe, already gone at this point, for another 5-mile, 2-hour walk before discarding her body in Finchley. Then, Mary walked home. Her trial commenced on December 1st, 1890 at the Old Bailey, which is the main criminal courthouse in London, where Mary pled not guilty. During the trial, Frank Hogg, multiple witnesses and neighbors, Phoebe's family, police officers, and the police surgeon testified for the prosecution. But there was not even one witness called for Mary's defense in the case. The only case the defense put forth was that the evidence against her was only circumstantial, and then he was like, "Well, she didn't try and run, did she? That has to count for something." Also in present day, by the way, it's often commented upon that her father was also hanged for murder when she would have been about 14, but that relationship has been disproven. They only had the same common last name of Wheeler, and there was no relation. If it had been true, I think it would have come up in some sort of insanity defense in her trial, but it did not. So nothing to stand on for an insanity defense there. All they've got is the prosecution's case is only circumstantial, and she didn't run. The trial lasted 3 days, and the jury deliberated for a total of 52 minutes before returning a verdict of guilty. Mary was sentenced to hang on December 23, 1890. On her final night, she was visited by her solicitor, who she made a bizarre request of. She asked him to place a personal advert in a Madrid newspaper that read 2MECP, last wish of MEW, have not betrayed. Now, MEW are the initials of her given name, Mary Eleanor Wheeler, but no one has any idea what any of this means, and she won't say a word further. It's just a mystery. Mary continued to assert her innocence until the very end. It's said the only time her composure really broke was when she realized that Frank was not going to come see her. When famed executioner James Berry, who served as a court's executioner from 1884 to 1890, went to fetch Mary, he described her as the most composed person in the whole execution party. Her final statement was, "My sentence is a just one, but a good deal of the evidence against me was false." Executions were becoming more humane at this point. There was a hood placed over her head, and she was executed using the long drop method, which results in a much quicker death from the breaking of the neck versus strangulation. A black flag is risen over the prison walls, and the crowds outside cheered. She was buried in the Newgate Prison Cemetery. As in most of these cases, the press coverage was extensive. Even before the end of the trial, Madame Tussaud's Wax Museum started working on a likeness of Mary Percy for their Chamber of Horrors exhibit. They also purchased the actual baby carriage to display, plus the knife, piano she played, and the entire contents of her kitchen, I believe, for display in the exhibit. The exhibit attracted over 30,000 people when it opened. Phoebe and her daughter are both buried at Isling and St. Pancras Cemetery in East Finchley, London, England. And it's not known what became of Frank Hogg. He just kind of faded into obscurity after the trial. Fun fact, Mary Percy often gets put forward as a Jill the Ripper suspect. This is more of a contemporary theory. She was not investigated at the time as a Jack the Ripper suspect, but those who like to entertain it point out the similarities in the way the throat was cut and the dumping of the body. But that's as far as it goes. Nothing about this matches Jack the Ripper's MO, and Mary has a very clear connection to her victim and motive in this case. So I think those who are fans of the Jill the Ripper theory are just kind of grasping at straws. If you are interested in Jack the Ripper, though, I just covered him in the episode right before this one, episode 9, so go check that out. So we can all agree that she did it, right? I mean, she wouldn't let them put forth an insanity defense, but she did act super weird during the investigation. And what do you make of that weird newspaper ad she asked to have placed? There is not even any remotely solid speculation on what that could be about that I could find. If you head over to Instagram or TikTok, at A Good Night for a Murder, you could let me know there, plus see some photos of Mary, her victims, some trial sketches, and also a map of the little walk Mary took herself on when she was trying to dispose of her victims. You can also see the photos and the source links on the episode blog on my website at agoodnightforamurder.com. While you're on the website, you can sign up for the Good Night for a Murder newsletter. Each month I send an episode roundup, reveal of next month's episodes, and other goodies like actual Victorian houses for sale, book recommendations, and more. The bonus content for housekeeper and butler to your patrons for this episode is another story of a famous Victorian era love triangle. To subscribe to Patreon and learn more about the podcast, you can visit agoodnightforamurder.com. Also follow me on Instagram or TikTok at agoodnightforamurder. Please rate and review and share with friends. Thank you for listening, and I will talk to you again soon.